Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And what do we have today, Rabbit?
Well, we're in Vermont. Everything seems to happen in Vermont.
Well, sometimes half the program's in Vermont, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, the first half of the program. And the first guest, a fascinating guest who came to us because she'd written a very interesting book. But it turns out that it's more than just an interesting book. It's a wonderful life story and a wonderful set of products as well.
And I loved talking to her. She was a real kindred spirit, and I love her cheeses.
Yep. We did try those too. And we have the original interview and then a segment on specifically on the subject of the cheeses that'll come right after that.
We're going to be talking to what I've come to think of as my alter ego. Is that a correct description of what it is that I was talking to you about, Angela Miller?
Hi, yeah.
Hi.
That's an apt description.
Yeah, we have so many things in common, but your story is just fascinating. It's called Hay Fever, the book is, you wrote about your story, and how chasing a dream on a Vermont farm changed my life. And Angela Miller is a goat cheese maker, a farmer, a book publicist, a cafe owner, wife, mother, what all
else? I would say.
Shall we say a slightly eccentric person?
Well, I don't know that she's that eccentric.
Seems to me
like she's perfectly normal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, like you do all those things, but you don't make goat cheese.
No, I don't. He keeps bringing this up,
and
Angela.
I don't do a radio show.
and you didn't buy a farm in the middle of Vermont, is it?
Yes, it's in Vermont. It's actually unusual because half of the farm is in New York State and half is in Vermont. But all the cheese making and buildings are on the Vermont side.
Well, you must be surrounded by stimulation because one after another of the interviews with artisanal products are all from Vermont.
Vermont is so supportive of its food heat makers.
And especially the cheese makers.
Yes, I think Vermont made a decision about 20-some years ago to put a lot of marketing attention to cheese and its dairy products and its maple syrup, and it's really exciting. If we had a longer growing season, I'm sure we'd be famous for our vegetables and fruits, but
we're jumping into the middle of this story, Angela. Do a little background picture for us. You were living in New York, in Manhattan, filling your life as a book publicist, right?
I was and am a literary agent.
A literary agent.
I represent many authors, and I present their books to publishers, negotiate the contract, and hold everyone's hand through the process.
That's the tough part.
A miracle for me to go through that process myself.
Uh-huh, which you did. And explain what you did.
Well, I had a writer visiting my farm, and his wife woke up at 5 in the morning, and she saw a slight figure carrying 2 bales of hay outside at 5 in the morning. And when I came in for breakfast at 8 in the morning, the writer friend said, "My God, you've got the nuttiest life I've ever seen. If you want to write a funny book, I'll help you." And I thought, me write a book? That's insane. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, now that I've done the farm and the cheese, I think it would be interesting for people who, and it might inspire people who have dreams, to go ahead and go out and learn to do different things, even in middle age.
But that's what people are doing. We have, who was that criminal attorney? He took up chocolate making, and I mean, endless examples of this.
That was a cogent reason for that, because he was fed up of having his life threatened because of people he had prosecuted. Now, Angela's story is not quite the same thing.
My authors, many of my authors are food writers and chefs, and I've been helping them with their cookbooks for over 20 years. So it did make some sense. I was working with a man named Max McCallman.
Who we've interviewed twice.
Okay, I represented all of his books, and he had just finished his first book. I bought the farm in Vermont, and he really helped me figure out how to get it going.
Well, if somebody knows about cheese, he does.
Exactly. So my cheese dreams were not modest. I knew immediately I wanted world-class cheese, award-winning cheese, because of my connections with people like Max and Terence Brennan and Jean-Georges Van Richten. I really wanted, the mission of this farm is to make award-winning cheeses, and we're actually achieving that now.
Now, you just won a big one recently, right?
We won runner-up best in show at the American Cheese Society.
That's it. That's not a minor award. This is a big thing.
It's not minor. It was for a cow's milk cheese called Rupert, and it's a 30-pound Alpine cheese, similar to the Gruyères. It has that nice nuttiness, and it's a very hard cheese. And we were absolutely stunned, and it was only the third time in Vermont history that a Vermont farm had come in at that level.
Now, we're going to come back and talk some more about cheese just later in the interview.
Okay.
But was there anything that you found particularly interesting or challenging when you actually took on the task of writing a book rather than just representing people who had?
I was terrified. I was terrified because I'd never written a book before. I'd only kept journals. I was nervous about writing a whole book about myself. That seemed insane. Insanely egotistical, but I had to keep telling myself I had something to say that might inspire people.
And is that what it was, that you felt that your experience was something that other people should know about?
I have had, during the last 7 years, I've had people come to me constantly asking me for advice and asking me how I did it, and places like Murray's Tea Shop would have me come and do a workshop or a class there, and I would get an entire classroom filled with lawyers, investment bankers who wanted to become farmers someday.
Yes, they either want to own a restaurant or become a farmer and make cheese.
Yeah, either one of them being a fast path to bankruptcy in most cases.
Exactly.
Now, how big is this farm, and how did you find it?
My farm is 305 acres, and it has four houses and three barns. And I found it because I was visiting in Dorset, Vermont in the Thanksgiving 2000, and I had sold our co-op in Manhattan, and we had some money jangling in our pockets, burning a hole right through the pocket, and we thought we might want to build a home here, since my husband is an architect.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was a big help, having a husband who's an architect.
Huge help. And
yes.
So we went.
Although, in your book, you said, to start out with, he was not so keen on this as an idea.
No. He's a city boy from London, and he kept wringing his hands, saying, what are we going to do with all that land? And I said, don't worry, it's easy. Land was always there. It always will be there. You don't have to worry about a thing, which was complete naivete.
Either that or a big lie.
he was incredibly smart about worrying, and that's the personality differences. And so we were looking for land. We couldn't find anything. And the very same day in the realtor's office, I saw pictures of a beautiful brick house and a big white barn, and I said, what's that? And they said, oh, you don't want that. That's too big. It's too much land. And I said, no, I want to see it. And I must have had that hunch. You know how they say love at first sight? Because we offered the asking price the next day.
Uh-huh.
And got it.
And now the farm's name is interesting. Consider Bardwell, who's a person, right?
He is, yes. He was the founder of the farm. His first name was Consider. He came from Massachusetts and married a Vermont girl. And he and her father bought this big tract of land, much bigger than it is now. And he started the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, predating the likes of Cabot.
Oh, that's
where
that's
local farmers would bring milk to this farm. And Consider Bardwell had a big building where they made cheese and took it to Boston and Albany on a local train.
Well, that's destiny.
It was just inevitable, right? I mean, you had this
big—you
had this big building to make cheese. What were you going to do? To turn it into a school?
Well, I actually initially had no idea about the farm history when I bought it, but very shortly thereafter, I was researching historical societies for information and found out about the cheese. And the light bulb went off. We can do this.
Well, through this whole story, which has a lot of drama packed into it as you're struggling to make your finances work, and so there's a parade of real characters that I got to be very fond of, and among them were the goats.
Ah, the girls, yes.
The girls, you call them.
I do.
Yeah, I mean, you have wonderful stories about the girls and the boys.
Uh-huh. Oh, the boys have a great life. In fact, we're just getting into that season now.
I see.
Goats breed in the fall in order to have spring babies. So our boys are very excited.
I bet.
They probably don't at this point realize why, but they'll get the message pretty soon.
I think their hormones are surging, and they're just walking around thinking, strutting around, looking very handsome.
You have wonderful descriptions of when you release them into the pasture. Now, we ought to say that your writing style is lively and easy, and it's a good read, listeners. It really is. And again, I said, I don't know how many characters you went through, but this is probably harder. The hardest part of your career is managing this cast of characters who have worked for you.
All of it was a big learning experience, but that was particularly hard for me. And I finally got to a place where I was really comfortable and understood how I needed to manage to be comfortable. And I had to decide that the happiness of the people working for me was of utmost importance.
Well, it's an inspirational story. We better not give away any more, because otherwise people won't buy a copy of Hay Fever, which they can do at OTM Bookshop, or they can do at the bookseller of their choice. So rush out and buy one and follow your dream, whether it's to farm goats or write a book or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
And you'll find the inspiration you need here from Angela Miller. Now, you said a moment ago that you have won prizes with your cow's cheese, but yet you're best known for goat cheese. Tell us something about the things you make there.
We make 7 different cheeses. 4 of them are made from the milk from dirty cows. We have a partner farm, and we milk 20 dirty cows. And we have our own goats, and we make 3 different goat's milk cheeses. We make fresh chèvre from May until October, and we make a bloomy rind called... The fresh chèvre is called Meadowy because we're in the Meadowy Valley.
Okay.
The second cheese is called Experience, and it's a small button that has a bloomy white bloomy rind on it. It's called Experience because Consider Bardwell's mother's name was Experience Bardwell.
Really? That's an unusual name.
What other names did they have in the family?
Every virtue you could think of. Mercy, patience.
Oh, so that's where they came from, I see.
Yes. And our third goat's milk cheese is a 3-pound tome called Manchester. Manchester is a town near us. And it's a washed rind, 4-month aged, lovely, nutty, hard goat cheeses. Very few people make this kind of cheese. Manchester has won second place at the American Cheese Society competitions and the World Cheese Competition. Then we make 4 cow's milk cheese. One called Dorset, which is a washed rind, pungent, the orange rind, and Dorset is, these are all named after towns around, that's our little gimmick, mm-hmm. if you will. Dorset, then we make a cheese called Paulette, P-A-W-L-E-T, and it's a 10-pound Italian-style Toma.
Oh, wow.
Again, a washed rind, and it has won a gold in the American Cheese Society in its class. And then the last one is Rupert, which is the one I mentioned earlier. It's a 30-pound wheel. We age it for a year, and it's absolutely beautiful. and one of our most popular. But the reason we have cows as well as goats, because we can milk cows all year, whereas goats are seasonal. They breed in the fall. We stop milking them by Christmas, December, and they have their babies in April, May, and we start making goat milk cheese in the late spring. So we need cheese to sell all year long.
Right. Now, you really have had a lot of help, because you didn't know this much about cheese when you started this.
No, I did not.
So you've had a resident cheesemaker help you as well?
As soon as we got going, Max McCalman suggested we contact a man named Peter Dixon. Mm-hmm. And Peter had been making cheese in Vermont for many years and is very well known. And so he was a consultant for a couple of years. And he developed all this whole, as they call it, product line, so that we would have a cheese for every consumer's taste.
It's a lot of cheese. It's a lot of cheese for such a small production. But
yes, he came on as a partner 3 years ago.
Oh, that's great. So now you have him sort of locked up for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Now, before we close, I just wanted to mention something that I think is possibly a better measure of how great your cheeses are than the gold medals and silver medals that you've won, because that's the restaurants where your cheeses are featured.
Yes, we've been extremely fortunate. Probably 1 month after we started making the fresh chèvre, it was on the tasting menu at Per Se in New York, and it was taken at the French Laundry. And now we're in every major four-star, Jean-Georges Van Risten, Danielle Bavoud, they all buy our cheeses every week.
This is wonderful.
We are working like crazy, but it's paying off in that sort of gratification that people who really, really know what their palate wants are buying the cheese.
Now, you haven't done a blue yet. Is a blue in your future?
My husband would like to do a blue.
I should think so.
Because he's English. As mine is.
I bet we will someday. But you have to have a lot of space dedicated to blue, because that
sits.
That blue vein is penicillium, and it gets into everything. You can't put it in a cave with any other cheeses.
Right.
Gotcha. Well, if the guy's a rogue creamery in Oregon can do it, I'm sure you can do it, and I'm sure you will, and you must let us know when you have some that you'd like for us to try.
All right, I definitely do that.
And in the meantime, thank you so much, Angela, for joining us.
Yeah, and I want to just conclude by saying I just admire you so much, and congratulations on your success.
Well, thank you very much.
And Rust is, when Rust goes away, he's going straight to heaven.
Yeah. He's going to listen to your show.
Okay, Angela, ciao now.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. It's not a coincidence that we're staying in Vermont for our next guest, because we deliberately put the next guest in Vermont and someone who also makes goat cheese.
Yeah, but they actually, I didn't know when we booked them for the interviews that they're neighbors and they know each other.
Because everybody in Vermont seems to know everybody else in Vermont anyway, especially if they make cheese. But this is a story not just about goat cheese. In fact, it's more about using goat milk to do something else altogether.
Yeah, Fat Toad Farm does make some cheese, but they're really focused on something a lot sweeter, which is goat's milk caramel toppings. We love good stories, and Callie Hastings of Fat Toad Farm has a good one. Welcome to On the Menu, Callie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, I was under this impression that you went back for generations with this goat farm, but that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not.
So it's a you said originally your property was an orchard and you made cider. But whose idea was it? Because you've been around these cheesemakers for a while. You worked with the Cheese Council, right?
Yeah, our property was an orchard before we got here. We still have the trees that are, 50, 60 years old. And then we moved here 26 years ago. But I had gone to school for agriculture, and my stepdad had always had animals, and we kind of wanted to get back into it as a family, and my sister as well. We were kind of interested in homesteading, and so we had always had large gardens, but we decided to get some goats because you want to have your own milk, and added to it with the chickens and the pigs. And at one point, we looked at each other and said, okay, we've got 8 goats that we're milking, and we need to either make this a business or cut back on the goats. And so we decided to start a business from that.
And how many goats do you have now?
We have 53, and most of them are pregnant. So if you do the math, that's about 80 to 100 goat babies next spring.
This is the season, right? This is the season for the ladies to get pregnant?
Yep, it's breeding season, and hopefully they're all pregnant by now. That's our goal. So.
Yeah, well, we were talking about Angela Miller, who's also a goat farmer and cheesemaker in Vermont. And if you read her book, she is so hysterically funny, discussing when they release the males into the females in breeding time.
we talked to her a few weeks ago, and she was talking about the fact that the boys were getting pretty excited.
Oh, yeah. They really like to pee on themselves. That's a big thing.
Oh, that's nice.
I don't know if people do that, but...
I think she did something about the beards.
I'm so glad you told us about that. We really,
oh, yes.
We really
Everyone
needed,
needs to know.
We really needed to know that. Now, so you started out conventionally milking goats and making goat cheese. Is that how things got off the ground?
Yeah, my sister had come back from Mexico. She has a piece of land there and has lived on and off there for many years. And something that's very popular there is something called cajeta, which is a traditional Mexican confection, and it's made from goat's milk. And it kind of goes back to when the ranchers or the farmers would have excess milk, and they would boil it down with sugar to preserve it when there wasn't refrigeration. So you got this kind of sweet caramel. And when she was there, she learned how to make it and ate it all the time because it was hugely popular there, and came back and started making it with our goat's milk, and we loved it, and our neighbors loved it, and we just thought it was such a unique product and started building the business on that. And we had also been making cheese in the kitchen, and people really enjoyed that, so we also built the cheese part of our business, and so now those are the two products that we make.
Now the name is rather intriguing. Toad.
Fat Toad.
is that a connection with the reptile of that variety, or is it just something you made up?
Well, when we were first getting into kind of the farm business, we were doing vegetables, and I had my degree, or I had gone to school for more vegetable production, so we were aiming in that direction, and there were toads everywhere in the gardens and out in the fields, and we just thought it was such a good indicator of biological diversity and a healthy ecosystem. So we're like, oh, fat toad. But then we turned into a goat dairy, so now it's Fat Toad Farm Goat Dairy. People are still intrigued, for sure.
So the toads were a healthy sign.
Yeah, definitely.
And are the toads extracting a fee because you're using their name?
Yeah, they get a profit. Part of a profit margin.
Now, you know all about all the biodiversity and sustainability and everything because you're a modern ag person, right?
Yeah, okay. I am. And my family's from Vermont. And they worked on cow dairies. And, it's an interesting combination, I think, of the kind of old school and the new school and everything in between.
Well, now let's give people an idea of the properties of the different kinds of fat toad caramel sauces. A lot of people in my native land associate caramels with candy. Now these are not candies; these are sauces.
Toppings.
Yep, they're all sauces that you would put on ice cream or on top of pies or in baked goods. My favorite thing is I have every morning before milking, I come into the house and I make, I take some of our goat's milk and I heat it up with baking cocoa and our caramel and mix it in, and that's kind of that's what I get started with every morning when I milk, and then I come in for a big breakfast afterwards. But it's not a candy. And people think of caramel as, well, a lot of it's made from high fructose corn syrup these days, but traditionally caramel is made from milk. And if you look at lots of different cultures from France to Argentina to Mexico, they all have their own version of this milk caramel. It hasn't become hugely popular in the U.S. except for, Häagen-Dazs, the dulce de leche flavor. And dulce de leche is the same thing, but it's cow's milk. It's cow's milk caramel.
So it's the same as dulce de leche.
Same, except goat's milk instead of cow's
milk,
basically.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, who was that fascinating guest we had on a few weeks ago who learned to make gelato? when he was in Argentina.
Oh yeah, I can't remember.
And then he came back. I mean, he was a businessman. He was a financial businessman, but he learned how to make gelato in Argentina. And after he came back to the United States, he got fed up of finance and founded a company making gelato and sorbetto. Talento.
Talento. Right. That's good stuff.
So I guess that it's a slight variant of the making of gelato and sorbetto is making caramel.
Well, it's also the dairy industry is such a hard place to be in with fluid milk, and for us it's a value-added dairy product, and it's possible for our farm to survive with it, and it makes a big difference to have a different type of product out there.
Now, you don't have milk for some short period of time, right? So from now until the little baby goats are born?
Just January and February are the 2 months that we're dry.
Okay, so you continue to make caramels during that time, though? You have enough goat's milk left over?
Nope, just at the end of December, and then no production in January and February, and okay. Then start up again in March.
So, but you still have the cheeses going. I mean, what are you like on the cheese side? There's a lot of tough competition in Vermont.
The cheese market?
Right.
Yeah, there's tons of amazing cheeses coming out of Vermont, and we only make cheese twice a week, and we make caramel five times a week, but the cheese, we just stick to a really simple, fresh Chèvre recipe, and that just means fresh goat cheese. And the cheese we only bring direct to stores. We drop off the day after it's made, and they're really kind of intimate relationships with our retailers that we sell to, and otherwise people can buy it online. But we've kept that kind of a very close-to-home product. And then the caramel, we've taken a different approach where we have the close-to-home, but we also sell in New York and Boston and Nashville.
Now, you have different flavors of caramel. You have different flavors.
Different flavors and sizes. Why didn't you run us through those?
Yeah, so we have 8-ounce jars, and we have... and 2-ounce jars. So 2-ounce are kind of like stocking stuffers and gifty size.
Yeah, I was wondering what to do with that because, I mean...
You keep them in the refrigerator and eat it with a spoon straight out of the jar.
Well, that's what we've done, yes.
So, what a silly question.
You won't believe this. We were having a dinner party, and we're not big on dessert, but some of the guests were. And one of them volunteered to bring...
brownies.
And so Peter jumped in right away and said, "Oh, good, we could put some caramel sauce on the bread."
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was a silly idea, don't you? You agree with me, don't you? You think it's a great idea.
Yeah, brownies, ice cream. Actually, one of my favorite recipes is this really dark chocolate brownie recipe, and then you swirl in the fresh goat cheese into the top and also caramel, so it's kind of like cream cheese caramel brownies.
See, you know about these things. Just because you don't know anything about desserts.
Yeah,
you don't understand that a sweet tooth can be in layers. as long as it gets sweeter and sweeter as you go along.
That's right. Well, I was always a chocolate person too, and we started making caramel. I was like, oh, I like caramel, but I really like chocolate. And so now I've become more of a caramel person, but I always try to find a way to put chocolate and caramel together.
Now, you don't hand milk these goats, do you?
We don't hand milk them. They're automated milkers. We do it twice a day, and it takes about an hour and a half or 2 hours. We do hand stir the caramel for 7 hours, though.
Do you?
Yeah.
How many people do you have stirring caramel?
Well, we take shifts, but usually someone's in there for a couple hours at a time. And it's basically we take the milk, all the fresh milk, and then organic cane sugar, and we put it in these copper cauldrons. We have 6 of them that are relatively small, but we put it in there and we mix it and we basically boil it for about 6 or 7 hours and stir it every couple minutes, and then at the end it's turned into this beautiful silky creamy caramel, and then we bottle it up. And
no, it is that. It's really... Now, how can people get the caramel?
Yeah,
you said about
this,
the cheese.
This is really good stuff, listeners. If you ever indulged in eating condensed milk straight out of the can when you were a child, this is a sensible adult step in the same direction.
That's right.
So how do people get some?
So on our website, we have a web store, so it's fattoadfarm.com, and people can always come visit us in Vermont and come to our farm store and take a tour, and then there's a list of all the stores that we sell our caramel and cheese and on our website, but we sell around the nation.
That's wonderful. It's a fascinating story, and I'm sure the toads are telling all their friends about this successful family who've become their neighbors.
We are
enjoying our indulgence in sweetness just a little bit at a time.
Great.
Is this a picture of you on the brochure, Callie?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's one of me
feeding the goats.
Yeah.
Feeding the goats, yeah. Anyhow, well, good talking to you, and listeners will be, I'm sure, checking out your website.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It was great talking with you.
Thanks, Callie. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
And now another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I'm really looking forward to our next interview. I always love talking to David Tanis, who is a brilliant cookbook author, as well as a brilliant and very inspirational food philosopher, shall we say. Anyhow.
He's also a chef, too. We forgot that part. What doesn't he do, I wonder? Well, you'll hear him talk about his latest contribution to the world of literature. And I'm sure you'll find it very interesting.
David Tanis, I could not agree with you any more than I do. I just love your philosophy of food, your stop cooking, and The Heart of the Artichoke book and Other Kitchen Journeys. Also loved Platter Fix, your previous book. And I love that you travel with your own chilies. You really do?
Oh, yes. I really do.
Is that because you can't? I used to travel with a garlic press, but now I don't press my garlic.
Yeah. You know, I always like to have a little bag of tricks just in case you get stranded somewhere and you've got to do a little food doctoring on
true.
The road.
Right.
So a little insurance is nice, and for me, part of the insurance is a couple of chilies in the pocket.
Uh-huh. Well, how would you describe your philosophy of food? You like simple, right?
Yes, simple. The simplest food is the best food, say that.
But you also have certain kitchen rituals, which is how you start your book.
Well, this book is divided into three sections. You know, the first section is small, and it's little kitchen rituals or some recipes for cooking for one, cooking for two, or just for having a good time in the kitchen alone, which I think is a lovely thing to do, spend time in the kitchen alone. And then the middle section has larger menus for 4 to 6, more for family dinners. And then at the end of the book is a section called Feasts for a Long Table.
Now I understand the small, medium, and large. I didn't immediately pick that up. But you're in love with baby artichokes, and Anne's in love with baby artichokes. She sent me off to the store today and said, don't tell me they don't have any baby artichokes, but of course they don't.
They don't?
No, well, we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and if we did have baby artichokes, they'd have way too many food miles on them.
Well, every once in a while you need to take a carbon credit for something else.
Right.
That's the right answer.
But actually, it's just beginning to be the best artichokes are in the fall and the spring. And I know whenever I was in New Jersey, when we were shooting the book a year ago, found some pretty nice baby artichokes, even at the local ShopRite.
Now, the answer is that they're just early season. Is that what it is?
For the small ones, you mean?
Yes.
No, the small ones grow on the same plant as the big ones.
Oh, they do?
Yeah,
okay.
They're just usually a little bit lower and little sort of side shoots, and they're just picked before they get big.
I see, okay. Now, what about the Roman artichokes, the purple one? Are they slightly different?
Well, it's a different variety, and they grow them for that particular size.
Yeah, because they are small by definition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're not like these baby ones because they still have prickly stuff at the center.
But explain a little bit more, because early in your book you say that you're a restaurant chef who prefers to cook at home.
This is true.
Now, that's pretty unusual.
Well, they tell me it's unusual, but I find home cooking the most satisfying cooking of all. And for me, it's a very pleasurable way to spend time.
And the recipes in this book follow that theme perfectly, right?
Yeah. Everything is relatively simple. Some dishes, well, actually in the book you have everything from how to make a perfect ham sandwich to how to make a mild cured ham. So some of the recipes involve a little investment of time, and some recipes require even waiting a few days before you complete them. But most of them are really easy, accessible, very doable recipes for the home cook, because I think people need to cook at home.
Now, you were a long-time chef at Chez Panisse. How many years?
Well, it's over 25 years.
Oh, wow.
Some of those years haven't been consecutive, but yes, I've been there since way back when.
Well, what is it like cooking at such an icon of this whole modern food movement.
Well, it's an honor, and it's but it's also the food at Chez Panisse is almost like home cooking. How the ingredients are treated and presented, so it's an unusual kind of place to work, but a wonderful place.
Now, then you started going to France for months at a time. Now, when did that start to happen?
I guess maybe in the late 90s. And well, actually, I tried to run away to France for a few years, and then I got dragged back, not really kicking and screaming, just we devised this particular schedule, I think, about 5 years ago. Now I split the year and work 6 months at the restaurant, and my colleague Jean-Pierre Moulet takes over for the other 6 months, and we each get to go to France in our time off.
Now, do you work when you're in France?
I do work a little bit, but I do a lot of writing. I do some private cooking, but time for sort of R&R.
Now, you're right around the corner from friends Michael and Bridget Rutenberg, who we stayed with in Paris, and right nearby is a restaurant called Chez Lamy-Louis.
Oh, yes.
Which some people describe as the ultimate Parisian bistro, and some people describe as the world's most expensive restaurant for what you get.
Well, the first time we went, the food was...
I was eliciting a comment from David there as to whether or not he had been there and what he thinks of it.
Well, first time I was ever there was 20 years ago, and it was already expensive then.
Yeah, I was going to say, the first time we went, it was already expensive.
Now, you know, it's under new ownership.
Right.
Because the old chef finally passed away. But actually, when I was there, he still sat in the window, and he was getting really old and on in years, but he did watch every plate go out. The thing about Lamy-Louis is it's a beautiful old stage set of a restaurant.
Yes.
and now it's a bit of a tourist trap.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think the time we went there, the green asparagus, or maybe it was the white asparagus, had just come in.
It was green, and it was $89.
Something like that. We know, because we had it, and that was what was on the bill. Potatoes there to die for.
Yes, and portions are rather large. I remember getting a slice of foie gras big enough to feed four people.
You know, we got a baby leg of lamb, and I mean, I couldn't imagine two people were supposed to be eating that.
And we called our banker immediately and said, please arrange a second mortgage so we can pay our bill.
Well, happily, there are more affordable places.
What's the place that we went to, Bridget, and Michael liked it so much? And
Pramil.
Do you know that one?
What is it called?
It's called Pramil, P-R-A-M-I-L.
I don't know it.
And it's on their street. It's on the Rue Nazareth, the Notre Dame.
Uh-huh.
There's a wine shop on that road.
Yeah.
Just beyond Les Amis-Louis.
Okay.
And right beyond that, on the opposite side of the street, is a restaurant called Pramil. And the owner is a school teacher who retired as a school teacher at age 55 because he wanted to open a restaurant. And
and
we made them so popular by having them on the menu that Michael and Bridget said they can't get in now. So there's a price for progress, I guess.
You know, you have the simple dishes that I grew up with. Asparagus scrambled eggs, for example.
Did you?
Yes. Now, my mother was, there were about third generation removed, but was really based on Sicilian cooking.
Uh-huh.
And that was a staple. Now, you have a lot of recipes like that in here that take me back to growing up, and yet you grew up in the Midwest, huh?
Yes, I kind of think of it as an accident of birth. I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know where I was supposed to be raised, but it was a good place to be a child.
Yeah, and you have like svinche, okay, with the honey. And we used to have them with anchovies spread, poked inside them.
Yes.
And sprinkled with the confectioner sugar.
Oh, well, you are Sicilian.
Oh, yeah. Truly. So, but you have a whole section called In a Sicilian Kitchen, which I was very grateful to read.
Well, I've really enjoyed all the time I've spent in Sicily. Mm-hmm. The food is really real there.
Yeah, and the other one was, I mean, every spring we had dandelion salad.
Yes.
But what we had was hard-boiled eggs sieved over the whole thing.
Nice.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, this is kind of cooking that you're espousing, but, I mean, it just took me back. I don't know why. I felt very happy reading your book and your recipes.
Oh, I'm pleased to hear it. I mean, most of the food in the book is based on traditional cooking from hither and yon. Kind of runs the gamut from Mexico to New Mexico to Morocco to Sicily. But all of the cooking has at its base simple ingredients and seasonal ingredients.
And sensible things to do with them when they might be out of season, like putting your leftover tomatoes in freezer bags and putting them in the freezer.
That's a good trick.
I discovered that about 10 years ago, and all the people who are anti-plastic think I'm some kind of a monster.
Yes, well, you can use those bags again.
Yes, you can.
we have about half a freezer full.
But now, isn't that a great thing to do? Instead of standing there making, my mother used to make all the sauce and all that, you know, business, and put them, season them, and put them up and can them. But this was, I was forced into I had so many of them, I had no time to do all that. I just washed them, dried them, and stuck them in these giant Ziploc bags and froze them.
Listeners, to get an idea of the wealth of things that are in this book, David, why don't you pick a couple of your favorite recipes?
And then just
talk us through the story associated with them, and then why you think they're so great.
I have to pick a favorite child.
Well, we'll be on the air for quite a while if you do 150. So yeah, we better make you be a little selective.
Well, this time of year when it's getting chilly, well, I'm a big proponent of braised meats and long simmered stews.
Yeah, Peter is too.
Sounds like a great place to be. I cooked dobe on Monday, which we had for dinner with friends on Tuesday, and I just finished the last of it for lunch today.
Well, you are a cook after my own heart.
There we go. So what's your favorite beef braise? Maybe it's not beef.
Well, I'm thinking of the lamb, the Moroccan
Tangy
lamb braise, I think it's called, fragrant lamb with prunes and almonds.
I'd love to read that one. I also like the rabbit variant of it. I think we might make that.
Oh, yeah.
Do we have any rabbits?
No, we have to find some more rabbits.
The recipe that begins, first kill your rabbit.
Well, that's actually Mrs. Beaton, I guess. First slaughter your ox.
Yeah, but no, I honed in on that one right away, because I love Middle Eastern cooking, Moroccan cooking particularly. So the spice, you can't go wrong with that, can you?
No, you can't at all, and it's one of those dishes, like you, as you say, that you can cook the day before and serve the following day, and it only improves.
Right.
Now let's go on to a second one.
Alrighty. What's the second one?
I don't know. You tell us. You're the one who's picking.
I have to tell you, I made this vegetables a la grec, although I didn't call it that. When we made vegetables a la grec, they were all put in a roasting pan, drizzled with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and stuck in the oven for a couple hours, very low temperature.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, but anyhow, mainly leaving them whole, too, pretty much whole. But this, the recipe you have, I made once for a vegetarian couple that came for dinner. And with the separate baths for each separate vegetables, I must have spent the whole day in the kitchen.
Oh.
I can show you came out of an old gourmet cookbook, which has all the splashes and drips and drabs all over the page.
Well, we still got to get David to move on to another favorite.
How about
speaking of the vegetables a la grec, that a favorite menu of mine is the one that's called Nearly Vegetarian.
Yes, I saw that.
Well, actually, it is, but that this particular menu is completely vegetarian, and it starts with vegetables a la grec, and then there's a really delicious, rich mushroom stew.
Oh, I love that.
That will fool anyone into thinking that they're eating something other than just mushrooms. It's really quite rich and an easy meal to put together on a weeknight, for instance.
What about your tongue recipe? We keep looking for interesting ways of having tongue.
Well, there you are. There's a little chapter called Bring Back Tongue.
Uh-huh.
I grew up on tongue. For us, it was just normal fare.
Same here.
And so I'm a tongue booster.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, our biggest problem is finding a source of supply for it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, we have one which we bought at a farmer's market, but it was the last one the farmer had left.
Yes.
And it's in the freezer because I'm damned if I'm going to go to all the trouble of prepping for the cooking of tongue, which takes a long time, to just do one.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of it is the USDA, the inspection process.
Anyway, so if there are any farmers listening, get in touch with us on the Menu Radio and tell us how many tongues you have.
Yes.
So we also just had a good beet salad. I'm glad you like beets as well.
Beets are a really delicious vegetable, and for people who only know canned beets, roasting your own beet is a great thing to do.
Uh-huh.
It concentrates the flavors, and they're easy then to peel and dress with a little zippy vinaigrette, and there's so many different ways you can go. It's nice with citrus, but it's also nice with chilies.
Chilied beets, I never thought about that.
Oh, yeah.
Try them
sometime.
You have that there in the book, too?
In the book is a traditional French salad of leeks vinaigrette, beets vinaigrette, and carrots vinaigrette. And for that one, it has a citrus But from time to time, I make a grated raw beet salad with Moroccan spices. Quite delicious. It's interesting, in France, when you go to the vegetable markets, the outdoor market, you know, every vegetable you buy is raw except for beets. And the beets you can buy already cooked.
Uh-huh.
But recently cooked, so you just take them home and then chop them up and go.
It's like that in England, too.
Yeah, they do them that way in England as well, although I must confess, a second cousin of mine who came to dinner once and we served beets said, asked us what it was, and we said it was beets, and she said, no, beets come in slices.
Yes.
You instill all these recipes, and you have little stories before all of your recipes, but you have a poet's soul, David.
Well, I like to tell those food stories, and I have a pile of them.
So there's room for more stories in another book, no doubt.
I expect there may be.
Now, you're probably already working on it. You must be really happy, though, to see that the food world has come around to your philosophy of cooking, or the spirit of cooking that you oppose. What do you hate about the food scene right now?
What do I hate about the food scene?
Right.
You know, fashion has its ups and downs, and the food scene, I think, has its ups and downs as well. I'm never one to squelch creativity, but sometimes people need to show a little restraint. I've been staying in a friend's house for the last few days, and there's a television there. I don't usually have a television at home. So I've been checking out modern culture by flipping the dial and seeing what's on TV. There's not very much good on TV.
Oh dear, yeah.
Discouraging.
What a discouraging thing to have to do.
Yeah, but I think that also, it's a little bit too bad what TV cooking shows have become, too. Such sort of competitions.
Yeah, and open canned soups and stuff, we're back to that.
I don't know. People shouldn't be afraid to cook. Cooking is a normal thing. Cooking is an everyday act, in my opinion. It's something that you do kind of like breathing. And as long as you have to do it, you might as well enjoy it. And you might as well get pleasure from it, because part of the whole idea, aside from nurturing the body, is to nurture the soul at the same time. And you have a lot of opportunities to make that happen during the day, even if it's just a little morning ritual of making coffee and toast.
Well, there's absolutely no question, David, that the heart of the artichoke and your previous book,
Ladder of Figs,
are both going to enable people to do that. So for your contribution to the world of people cooking in a civilized fashion, cooking at home, contribution is hereby recognized, and On the Menu Radio is really proud of you. And thank you so much for joining us today.
And I'd love to have a chance to cook with you sometime.
Let's do it. I love that.
Make bread.
Yes.
How about spinach bread? You know that one?
I know it, but I want to learn your version.
Okay, it's Sicilian. Okay, David, thanks so much, and here's success with this book.
Thank you all.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Now it's time for us to take another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and talk about enjoying talking to somebody. We always love talking to Lydia Bastianich. She always has something new that she's done, and here she is telling us about her very first children's book.
And don't forget also this wonderful new enterprise, this food enterprise
Italy.
In New York City called Italy, which you're going to want to hear about as well. So here's Lydia with a Christmas gift suggestion.
Right.
Since that's the season coming up, and a fascinating story of this wonderful new food venture that I just mentioned.
It's always such a delight talking to Lydia Bastianich. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, Ann.
Well, you've done it again. Every time I turn around, you're into a new project. And right on the heels of Italy, I'm going to ask you about that in a little bit, you've written a children's book, Nona, Tell Me a Story. Now, it's a natural, you said. Tell us the story about the book.
Well, I have 5 grandchildren, and they were small. I began to sort of crush herbs under their noses and get them into the smells of food. And as I got older, I began telling them the stories when I was a little girl, what I did, how I grew up with my grandmother, and she had all the farm animals, and we planted in the garden. And I think these are all such essential basics for food. I certainly wanted to share it with my grandchildren. Well, my grandchildren, even today, and they're 8 to 12, 5 of them, when they come over, Noni, tell me a story when you were a little girl. Still,
oh, really?
Still goes on. And so this was one of the stories, the story about the Christmas tree when I was a little girl. The Christmas tree when I was a little girl was really simplistic. It was edible at the end of the day.
Well, the story, of course, is centers on the importance of family traditions, cultural traditions. You said the hardest part of this was the illustrations, and I just think they're superb.
Well, I had written these stories. As I was telling them, I said, well, I better write them down so that the children will have them, you know, as part of their who they are. And then this little kind of vignette, as my daughters and everybody was reading it, I said, gee, you know, this would make a great children's story. And we ultimately got it into a story, and then it was evident that the family was involved. This, I was telling that to my family, and we were all real. So we had to get our illustrations in order now of us, the real people. And that was funny because I had to send pictures to the illustrator, character descriptions. Then, and when the illustration came back, I shared them with each character, with my grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
And they had their 2 cents. Oh, you know, I don't like my eyes, I don't like my hair. But it was fun. I think she really captured us.
So the artist never really met everybody?
No, not everybody. Down the line, yes. But initially, you know, it was pictures. It was descriptions of character that their mother wrote, I wrote as a grandma and so on. And I think they were really all captured well.
And certainly think so, and she's very critical of things artistic. So if you got it right, must be good. Now, is it a good story? I didn't read the story. Is it a good story?
Yeah, it centers on tradition, Lydia has a vaults full of family traditions, haven't you, Lydia?
I do, and I think they're so important. Yes, the book tells a story about making the Christmas tree maybe not so contemporary with all the glitters and everything sort of store-bought, but making an organic tree, baking cookies together, tying tangerines up on the tree, making wreaths out of dried figs. That's what we did.
And you still do that?
Yeah, to some extent, absolutely. You know, it's difficult to transport that time into today's time.
Yes.
But it evolves. And the evolution is exactly what you said, and is the traditions. How do we incorporate contemporary today traditions of families into maybe some of the basic values that were, and that is to be very mindful of not wasting, of the earth around us, keeping it green. You know, we used to get a little tree, a little bush, a juniper bush,
uh-huh.
Not a big tree. We didn't chop down a big tree to have our Christmas tree, and so on, all of these things. But I think the important message is here to be together, to create memories together, bake together, and children love that. Children love to get their hands into dough and cook.
Now, are there some recipes in here, too?
Absolutely.
Of course there are. Of course there are.
Otherwise,
what a silly question.
Exactly. How would they put to practice what I'm preaching here?
Okay, so you encapsulated that for them, too.
Yes, and it is a great... I hope this book should be a reference book in the kitchen and stay there, not put away for the holidays. Because it has 14 great recipes for children. Some of them are very traditional recipes that I made as a child. Some of them are much more contemporary, you know, for the children of today. Like I give them little cupcakes, angel food cupcakes, are, you know, very nutritionally sensible. Then I know my kids like chocolate chip and oatmeal chocolate chip cookie. And there's 2 recipes for flourless cookies, the Brutti Mabuoni and the pinoli cookies, just the almond paste rather, so that people that have gluten problems, So, you know, it's a conscientious choice of recipes for today.
So now you're going to have literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of grandchildren.
I love it. Some of the, I must say, the greatest reward out of all of this, you know, one would ask, is that I find myself invited in people's home and millions that I don't even know. And here is Lydia's recipe. I get emails and they say, you know, we're having a Lydia supper tonight.
You're kidding.
I just love it.
Yeah. Now, what was your grandchildren's reaction when they actually saw the finished product?
Well, no, they were so much involved in it. They love it. They took it. When it was first released immediately, I sent them all a copy and signed it. They took it right to school. They wanted to share it with their teacher, with their friends. And, of course, they were very proud of being the protagonists of this story.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. Great. This is going to be a big hit for the Christmas season, I feel sure. And then it'll probably just keep on going because everybody want to have their own copy. It's such a charming testament to yourself and to the heritage that you represent. Now, Anne wanted to ask you about something else you're up to as well, because writing children's books and writing other cookbooks just wasn't enough. Owning several restaurants isn't enough. You had to do something really big.
but you know, it's not that it's not enough or you wanted something more. It's the opportunities that kind of come, and you just can't refuse because you know that something like that could be successful, that people would appreciate it. And when you have all the elements together, it's got to happen. I assume you're talking about Italy.
Yeah, Italy, yes.
Italy.
Very, very clever plan was. Now, there is an Italy already, correct? There was in addition to yours, there's an Italy already in Italy.
Right. There's an Italy, Eataly, in Italy.
There you go.
In Piemonte, in Torino, in Italy, there is the original store. And Oscar Farinetti was the sort of the brainchild behind. And I knew Oscar, and, you know, I went there, and I did an event. I did a dinner. And he explained to me, you know, how much he wanted to come to the United States, and that he felt that this concept of a specialty store with the really unique, the slow food kind of products of Italy, those traditional
right.
products, plus having restaurants within, dispersed within this retail store, if you will, where one could buy fresh fish, fresh meat, and eat it cooked, have restaurants. So we have 7 restaurants in Italy here, and besides, you know, the fruit markets and the markets, and we make our own bread, and we have pizza from Naples, a wood-burning pizza oven. We have a pasta restaurant. We have a pesce fish. We have Manzo restaurant, which is a sit-down restaurant where you eat basically meat. Mm-hmm. So it is this kind of 50,000 square feet.
That's huge. I mean, Lydia, and when you were planning this, it probably was the glumest time in the retail market or in the food market or any market, right, financially.
Yeah, but that's why, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people, in a sense, involved. Oscar, you know, wanted, and so he is the big investor. And then, of course, you know, I told Oscar, I said, you know, I can't do this by myself. If the boys want to do it, meaning Mario Battali and Joseph Bastianich, my sons.
Yeah.
And, of course, they got involved. And then we have 2 young brothers, the Saper brothers, also, who are American. And they fell in love with Italian culture. So this is a group of really competent individuals, each knowing their own kind of department, and it's been quite successful, Anne.
Yeah, it was nicely received.
Oh, certainly, the press.
Yes.
It reminds me a little bit, Lydia, of a place in Bologna called, is it Tamburini's?
Oh, I know Tamburini. Absolutely.
I forgot about him. He's fun.
So it's not just something made up new and modern. I mean, these kinds of shops exist throughout Italy. Maybe not quite as comprehensive as Italy, but certainly it's a slice of Italy. Another one transplanted here into the United States, and the community apparently is welcoming it and crowding there. So
I haven't heard a bad thing about it at all. It all praise raves actually.
And Anne's antennas are always up, just in case. Although she hasn't heard anything.
we try not to miss anything, but sometimes we do.
I look forward to next time in Manhattan to do that. Lydia, bring us up to date on a couple of other things. Number one, you just have a new website.
Yes.
And you said it's wonderful and it's interactive. Give us that website? Address?
Oh, I am so excited about it. It's www. Lydia Zitali, all one word, no apostrophe, L-I, D-I-S, Italy. It's great because we're streaming my shows on it. We have the communal table where we share recipes. I just had a question today about this. She asked me, she says, Lydia, I love your chicken and potatoes, grandma's chicken and potatoes. Can you recommend? So I recommended a whole meal and the wine to go with it for her to plan. So this kind of interactive activities. So we are very excited. And we love for you to go on and tell us what you think about it.
I will. I will indeed. I told you that I had this quirk in my mail scanner program that said it was spam. But I will go back on it.
You fixed that. Well, I knew about lydiasitaly.com for a long time.
This is a new one.
Because I send, it's always been Lydia's email address.
Yeah, but this is a whole new site, brand new.
I got the message.
Oh, I had another question.
Yes.
Is now the fish store, in Italy,
uh-huh.
Is David permanently there or just
David? Yeah, David supervises it. So we have, how the store runs is that we have a fresh fish market, and we have for our restaurants our own fish guys going every morning at 2:00 in the morning to the market. So we get fresh fish. You can buy the fresh fish, but right in back of it, there's a counter and sitting area where Dave Pasternak is in charge of a fish restaurant. So it's under his tutelage. He is there periodically, but, he runs ESCA.
But he's still at ESCA. I love David. Well, listen, Lydia, when are you coming to visit us again?
Oh, I was just there. I think it was in and out. I did something for public television there and whatever. I was there 3 weeks ago.
We were in Tuscany.
Yeah, we missed you.
We had a little get-together, but you were not around.
Yeah, I was in Tuscany, I think.
Well, keep up the great work, and happy holidays to you coming up very soon, Lydia. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Lydia. Happy holidays to both of you.
Thank you,
and
sweet.
Everybody else.
Okay, bye-bye.
Arrivederci.
Arrivederci.
Thank you for spending the last hour with us. We hope you enjoyed the broadcast, and we'll look forward to talking to you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.